Thanks, Jan. Let me also thank Robin and the other organizers for inviting me to this great conference. I will start with needs for generating isolated after-second X-ray pulses via high harmonic generation. Since this is an X-ray conference, I have to admit that we after-second guys are softies in terms of photon energy, and we of course are doing lots of efforts to get to the KeV range. And is there actually a pointer? This one? Perfect. So there are several approaches how to go to the X-ray regime, and I would like to introduce the one that we are pursuing, which is using phase double few cycle driver pulses in the future at long wavelengths. Of course, there are also other ways to get to single isolated after-second pulses, like polarization gating, double polarization gating, as Senghu is doing, or other ways to go to the X-ray regime, like quasi-phase matching, as Henry and Margaret are doing. But long wavelength is also on the scope of other groups. Ludi Moro, for example, is also working in this direction. Then I'd like to introduce after-second measurement technique that is maybe well known, which is streaking. But I think the audience is heterogeneous enough that I say a few words on this. And then I'd like to address the question what to do with after-second pulses, since Peter Lampropoulos yesterday told me that the workshop to find an answer on this question, but they seem to fail. In the end, I will talk about pulse duration measurement at LCLS, which we did in the last run 2 weeks ago. So what we are right now still using as the driver system for generating after-second pulses is titanium sapphire systems, sub-10 femtosecond pulse oscillators, then using amplifiers, and then using a system which I will introduce on the next slide to increase the bandwidth of the laser pulses so that they support sub 3.5 femtosecond pulse durations. You will see later on why this is so important, and of course we would like to have more than these lousy 400 microjoule pulses energy. And that's why we are working on a booster system, which right now has about 4 millijoule, 28 femtoseconds, but it's still pretty tricky to get this through the holocore fiber. The holocore fiber is simply a fiber which is filled with neon gas, so that due to self-phase modulation, you increase drastically the bandwidth of the laser pulse. And as you can see here in the spectrum, we go from something like 400, 450 nanometers to 1,000 nanometers, so it's covering the whole visible range, which makes it extremely difficult to find laser safety goggles, because an aluminum plate would be the appropriate thing. You can see here we have pulse durations of less than 3.5 femtoseconds. This is close to the natural limit of one oscillation cycle of the driver wavelength. So we are pretty close to single cycle pulses. If you have such short pulses, then the carrier envelope phase gets more and more important, and we call it a cosine waveform if the maximum of the electric field coincides with the maximum of the pulse envelope, and the sine pulse if we have a zero transition here at the maximum of the envelope, just for your understanding of the next things. And if you want to control the phase, you have to find a way how to measure it. And Gerhard Paulus came up quite some years ago already with a technique that is called stereo ATI phase meter, because he's looking on ATI spectra on two different sides of the polarization axis. And as you can see here, if the carrier envelope phase changes, then the spectra measured on the two different detectors change quite significantly. And we've found a way 2 years ago, to improve this system such that we are able now to measure the phase of each single pulse consecutively, so that we can measure the evolution of the carrier envelope phase. And I don't want to go too much into detail, but we are just measuring the asymmetry on these spectra, on these ATI spectra between the left and the right time of flight signal. And from these asymmetry curves that we get, we find a parametric distribution with which we can identify unambiguously the carrier envelope phase of the pulses. And you see, if we have a non-phase stabilized laser, then the laser pulses pop up at different positions on this phase potato, as we call it. So you really see that there is a random distribution from shot to shot. And this is maybe even more important than the slide I show next, because this means that if you have a high power laser where you, due to the low repetition rate, you're not able to stabilize the carrier envelope phase, you can do phase tagging. So you can measure something, you measure simultaneously the carrier envelope phase, and then you can sort the shots of your measurements with respect to the carrier envelope phase. And this is, of course, what you get with a phase stabilized laser. You see, you can change the phase in small steps and with a certain distribution, which may be narrower or wider, you can stabilize the phase to a certain point on this phase circle. I don't want to go too much into detail in high-order harmonic generation, because I think everybody of you knows this three-step model of Paul Corcoran, where an electron is liberated due to field ionization, is then accelerated and recombines in order to emit harmonic radiation. But what I said in the beginning is that we are pursuing the way to go to longer wavelength drivers. Maybe counterintuitive that with longer wavelengths you get higher harmonics, but if you look at this simple picture, you see that the semi-classical picture, that the electron just makes a longer trip through the continuum and can accumulate more energy in this way. Mathematically, it is expressed in this ponderomotive potential, which scales with the square of the wavelength. And there have been calculations that you do not only extend the cutoff, but also that if you use, for example, a 2 micron driver laser, you get much more conversion efficiency at higher photon energies here at several hundred electron volts. And that's why we are going to OPCPA systems, optical parametric searcher pulse amplifiers. The maybe most complicated thing here is to develop a driver laser that supports short pulses in the picosecond regime with sufficient pulse energy. And we had a first setup where we got down to 1 millijoule, 15 femtoseconds. The 15 femtoseconds are maybe more remarkable than they seem to be, because at this wavelength, this is also less than 2 optical cycles. 0.9 millijoule was not enough. That's why we were developing a disk region system. You see here 3 kilohertz, 1.5 picosecond, 27 millijoules, and we're now about to get more than 2 microjoules. And this is important because with the old setup, we did some harmonic generation experiments, and you can see we got harmonic radiation up to 1.5 kilo electron volts, which is promising, I think. But as you can see here, this was integrated over, let's say, more than a minute. The flux was still pretty lousy, so we really have to work on this. Let me come back to the harmonic generation process. If you look at a multi-cycle driver, you see that this process of harmonic generation occurs at every half cycle of the driving field, so you get out a train of attosecond bursts. If you use a few cycle pulse, then you have fewer instants where the harmonic emission happens. And also what is interesting is that due to the fact that you have, For example, in a cosine pulse, one pronounced maximum of the electric field, you get the highest energy photons right after this maximum. And if you look in the spectral domain, you see here this harmonic spectrum and a smooth cut-off region, which indicates a single event. And if you are able to filter out this smooth cut-off region, then you get a single attosecond pulse. If you do this, for example, with a sine pulse, then you would see, due to the fact that you have equal maxima here, the photon energy at these two instants is the same. You get a modulated spectrum and a double pulse, which you would not like to have. So our setup is so that we generate the harmonics in a gas nozzle, and then we have an annual beam due to the fact that the harmonic radiation has a lower divergence than the fundamental. We're now using a multi-layer mirror, which is the spectral filter that I was talking of. And also, as you can see, it's a double mirror where the inner part can be moved with respect to the outer part so that you can introduce a delay between the attosecond pulse and the infrared field. And then we are performing our experiments here, showing an example of a gas nozzle where we ionize and measure the electron energy in this time-of-flight spectrometer. Lou DiMauro has already shown this image. What happens, the attosecond pulse ionizes, gives an initial momentum to the electron, and the electron then gains additional momentum from the laser field. So if you do this now at different instants of time, the ionization takes place at different phases of the infrared field, then you will see that these electrons born at different instants of time end up with different momenta. And this is, so to say, a mapping of time to energy. So at different instants of time, you get different final energies. And if you look at this double feature in time, which is an X-ray pulse or an X-UV pulse, and then transferred to the electron bunches, then you see also this double structure in the energy. And if you compare a shorter to a longer pulse, you see immediately what happens. It's in principle nothing else than a street camera, as Wheatstone proposed 175 years ago, where he mapped time to space by a rotating mirror. We are mapping time to energy. If you now change the delay between the attosecond pulse and the infrared field, you see that the photoelectron spectrum is moving up and down. And this was done a few years ago already. So you can see this streaking trace, which measures the electric field of the laser pulse to be corrected, so vector potential. Now, latest results, you can see that our laser pulses are getting pretty short. This is really only 1.5 oscillation cycles. And also, the probing pulses have been made as short as 80 attosecond pulses. For those who are not familiar to laser, let's call it facilities, this is how it looks like. You have a laser, and then in the end, harmonic generation and the experimental setup. So it's pretty small compared to other X-ray facilities. Now, with these tools at hand, of course, we would like to do some physics. And if we look at this model system, what can you do with an attosecond pulse? You can ionize and kick out valence band electrons, core level electrons with the photon energy that is sufficient. You can trigger an O'Shea decay or induce a shake-up process. And maybe the most interesting thing, a convolution of all these things, which can be arbitrarily complicated. And at this point, time-resolved measurements have to come into play, because you would not be able to reveal the process only from the spectral domain. All these electrons, no matter how they were born, can be streaked. And from that, you get information on the underlying process. We have chosen a solid as a sample system to look at this ionization process. And if you shine an X-UV pulse on this solid, you will see that an electron first has to travel to the surface before it sees the infrared field. I will talk about this later, and this may be one very interesting question. So the infrared field is then streaking the electron, and you get a streaking curve, as you saw before. If you now address two different types of electrons, for example, a valence band electron, a core level electron, it might be that these two guys travel to the surface at a different speed. And if you now shine the streaking field on it, then you will see a certain delay in the streaking curves, which you can see here, that indicates the different arrival time of the electrons at the surface. And we did this already a few years ago and saw that we have a delay between these two types of electrons. We measured this in tungsten of about 100 attoseconds. Now, of course, we were very interested to see what happens in different materials at different photon energies, and we did this to verify our results. And we saw at different systems, different photon energies, always a delay of about 55 to 90, 100 attoseconds. Now the question is, what is the origin of the delay? Of course, it must be kind of a propagation effect, and this is the assumption that has already been discussed quite intensively. So the assumption is that the streaking only acts outside the solid. In our setup, we can say that the normal component of the electric field outside is 16 times higher than inside the solid. But of course, it would be extremely interesting to know what happens in the first layer of the solid, because already the ancient Greeks knew that natura non facit saltus, so there is no jump, but there must be something in this first layer. And this might affect also the whole measurement that we do. We, of course, have different inelastic mean free paths, so we have a different depth profile for these two types of electrons. And also a very interesting question, which has very many different opinions in the solid state community, is could it be a different group velocity? Is it a final state effect? Do the electrons already know that they are in a solid on this time scale? So there is quite some open questions. Of course, we could only measure a relative delay between these two types of electrons. And what would be much more interesting is the absolute emission time, so the absolute time that it takes the electrons to get to the surface. So we wanted to do a reference measurement with a system where we assumed that we have instantaneous emission and compare this to the emission of the two electrons. And so we were blowing gas on the sample, but you can imagine that we had quite some geometric effects, because the gas fills the whole focal volume of the laser and the XUV pulse. So this was not appropriate. And also, quite interestingly, we found that our reference, which was neon, cannot be considered as a completely instantaneous reference, because if we looked carefully at the 2s and 2p electrons, we found that already these two guys are delayed by about 20 attoseconds, which to some part, about 6 attoseconds, could be explained theoretically. The other, like 15 attoseconds, are not yet completely clear. So our other approach was now to put an overlayer on this substrate, one monolayer of a noble gas, freeze it on the surface, so to have a time zero marker. And this is what we measured recently. We were freezing xenon monolayers on rhenium, and you can see the streaking curves of these different electrons. Unfortunately, the rhenium conduction band and the xenon 5p are pretty close together, but then you see the other streaking curves. And the result of this measurement was that the order of appearance was like xenon 5p, xenon 4d as expected, then the rhenium conduction band and the rhenium 4f. So we had a time delay of 46 attoseconds between these two guys, and then 60 attoseconds to the rhenium conduction band. This was, well, not really extremely clear. And also something that caused, again, even more confusion was that we now took the opportunity and measured delay in atomic xenon in the gas phase, and we found something like 20 attoseconds delay, which is comparable to the neon data. But when we were freezing like 50 layers of xenon on a sample, we found interestingly that the order of appearance flipped between 5P and 4D. So here the transport effects come into play. Now our next approach was to measure this with a different number of layers so that we can say, okay, we have one layer, we have two layers, we have three layers on the system under investigation, and then watch what happens with the electrons that have to propagate through these layers. And so we were bringing magnesium on our tungsten samples, and you can see here the different photo lines of magnesium and tungsten. And with one monolayer, we saw that the conduction band was delayed by 10 attoseconds and the 4F was delayed by 117 attoseconds. Again, you see the 100 attosecond delay as we know from the clear sample. And now with the bilayer on it, we see interestingly that now the conduction band electrons need 70 attoseconds to get through, and the 4F need 170 attoseconds. So this is kind of consistent with what you expected. And so we are right now doing a lot of data analysis to get through. And of course, there is a lot of theory to be done here to fully understand this. And we also still have another idea to use dielectric multilayers, because due to the fact that in a metal, you would have an extension of the delocalized wave function. In a different situation here, we might learn something from this setup. So what is the outlook? What are we going to do next? We're trying to, generating UV pulses for excitation of molecules in order to be able to do UV pump X-UV probe experiments, or in the future, UV pump X-ray probe experiments. Also, and then use this, for example, to measure charge transfer in molecules and solids. And so this is the goal, that we have a UV pulse to excite a system, and then a probe pulse to probe this. And here is the setup. What we did, we used a similar setup to generate the third harmonic in the gas phase in order to get a UV pulse, and then measured the pulse duration. So you can see here the spectra. We get the third harmonic, and if we do not suppress this, also the fifth harmonic of our pulses. And those who are familiar with frog traces, this is the measured pulse duration messages that we are able to get sub 4 femtosecond UV pulses. We then did an autocorrelation trace in krypton and found that we even can get down to sub 3 femtosecond pulses. And we have now set up a vacuum chamber where we have the harmonic generation somewhere here in the second chamber. And then we use a mirror with a hole that the high harmonics can pass through. And then with the infrared laser, we can do the UV generation. And then we combine these two pulses so that we can do UV pump X-UV probe experiments. But also, we were thinking of a collinear generation of UV and X-UV pulses. So we have our 100 electron volts X-UV radiation and our sub 4 femtosecond pulses in the 5 EV range. And now we're putting together these two targets. And you can see here on the photo that it worked quite nicely, and that we get out a still very nice spectrum in the 100 electron volt regime, and a good third harmonic spectrum about 5 electron volts. So we now have this at our disposal. And for example, just as a proof of principle experiment, we are going to look at ozone, since the absorption cross section in the UV is extremely high, and excite a wave packet with the fundamental and the third harmonic, and then probe this with the XUV beam. The future goal, of course, is to look at more complicated molecules, to use a UV pump to excite electrons or create holes, and then probe this with an XUV or X-ray attosecond pulse. There have been calculations from Françoise Remacle and Raphaël Levine who were observing that a hole that you generate travels back and forth along such a molecular chain, and that the photoelectron spectrum that you get out is dependent on this position, and you could with that get information on that. Before I come to the LCLS data, I would like to acknowledge the big group here at the Max Planck Institute who is working on all this and all the collaborations that we have, especially on theory and on surface dynamics, since we have to kind of put in additional know-how. So now let me go to the pulse duration measurement at LCLS. This is a very fruitful collaboration with guys from DESI, CIFEL, Ohio State University, Ludy Morrow already mentioned it yesterday, Dublin University and SLEC. I hope I didn't forget anybody. Lou showed it already yesterday that there is a big difference if you have a so-called long X-ray pulse or a short X-ray pulse. And what do I mean by long? Long means that the pulse duration is significantly shorter than half an oscillation cycle of a dressing field. If this is the case, and you generate photoelectrons or whatever electrons with such an X-ray pulse, then these X-ray pulse these electrons will end up with a sideband feature if they see a dressing field where the sidebands are separated by the photon energy of the dressing field. If you have a short pulse, and this was the scenario I was talking about in the last 25 minutes, then you will see a streaking feature. So the photoelectrons will be upshifted, downshifted, broadened according to their delay with respect to the dressing field. And now the question is, what is short? Short means that the pulse duration of the X-rays is shorter than an optical half cycle. So in order to be able to measure something at the LCLS, we have chosen an infrared laser at 2 microns, since half the oscillation period is about 3.3 femtoseconds here. So if LCLS is capable of providing pulses that are shorter than these 3.3 femtoseconds, we will be able to see such a streaking feature and then conclude on the pulse duration. Now, to make it short, I show a trace. So this is time delay between the X-ray pulse and the dressing laser pulse that had about 40 femtoseconds. The spectra were sorted according to the phase cavity timer. This is what Lou has already explained yesterday. What you can see here, if we have a long pulse, so in the 200 picocoulomb mode, kind of 50, 70 femtoseconds or so, then you will see that, well, unfortunately, you don't see it very well, but you can see here that you have a kind of sideband-like feature, but you cannot resolve the sidebands due to the fact that our spectrometer doesn't have enough resolution, and of course, due to the fact that we are using an infrared driver laser, these sidebands are only separated by 0.5 electron volts, so you would not be able to see this. But if you now compare this to pulses where we assumed that they are significantly shorter than one half cycle of our driving laser, our dressing laser, then you see that we see a kind of streaking feature. So the photo line is really shifted up by tens of electron volts. You see this sorting to the phase cavity is only very rough. It, of course, does not include a exact information on the timing jitter. So now you will maybe ask yourself the question, how can you conclude on the pulse duration? I'll try to illustrate this here. If you have an X-ray pulse, a pretty short X-ray pulse, and you do photoionization, you will get the photoelectron line. Now, if you add a dressing field and you know that you have time jitter, then the temporal position of the photoelectrons that you have will be arbitrary with respect to the field of the infrared pulse. And if you maybe end up at this position here, then the photo line will be shifted by a certain amount. If you end up here at the maximum of the vector potential, I'm not here drawing the vector potential because it's easier, then you will end up with the maximum shift. And this maximum shift will give you the information on the maximum vector potential, which is extremely important. If you look at spectra, final spectra, that are not moved, but that are broadened due to the fact that they are here at a zero transition of the vector potential of the laser, then you will see that there is broadening and maximum broadening if the X-ray pulse coincides with the maximum streaking slope here. So from this broadened spectrum, you can then retrieve the pulse duration of the X-rays. Unfortunately, we have to take into account that the photon energy jitters. The photon energy jitters, so even without the streaking field, it jitters. If we are looking at a photo line at like 1 kiloelectron volt, it jitters by around 1%. And also, the bandwidth of the X-ray pulse is jitter. We measured something like 7 electron volt plus 3, so we did not measure narrow, but something between 7 and 10 electron volts. So with this assumption, we can conclude on the pulse duration. And here you see what we have measured. So we were looking at the neon 1S line at an X-ray photon energy of 1.8 kilo electron volts, so that the photoelectron had something like 930 electron volts. And you can see at different single shots, we saw shifted photo lines, which we never, of course, observed without the dressing laser, and broadened photo lines. Also, we have to investigate carefully if this double structure that pops up sometimes could mean that we see something like a substructure. I do not want to make a big statement here because these data are only 12 days old, and there is a lot of time to do data evaluation in front of us. But also, maybe interesting, if you look at unstreaked blue and streaked photoelectron spectra at different electron energies. So we were looking at the 1S line at an excitation energy of 1 keV, so we had 130 eV, and here 950 electron volts again with 1.82 kilo electron volts. You see that the amount of delta E that you can shift the photo line is quite some different, and this is due to the formula that Lou has presented yesterday. So you have a dependence on the initial electron energy, the square of the initial energy. So if you now compare 130 electron volts to 950 electron volts, you have a factor of 9, square is about 3, and this is exactly what we observe, something like 40 electron volts maximum. Maybe we did not take the maximum shift here, and something like 120 electron volts maximum shift here. And with that, I would like to thank you for your attention.
Thanks a lot, Reinhard. Are there questions?
It's very interesting, your experiments on absolute time of emission, because it reminds us that the founders of quantum mechanics had great trouble with the old guard who said, including Einstein, that, you know, the problem with quantum mechanics is it cannot predict a particular instant at which a transition occurs. But any measurement of time will have an error, and all you need is a transition rate for that. So is there something fundamental here that I'm missing? On the why you want to measure the absolute time, that this electron called Peter, it was emitted at noon.
Well, actually, yes. I think it's quite interesting to I mean, if you look how solid state physics models things, I mean, there is Chelium models and things like this. Maybe the modulation can be adapted to what we see. I mean, if it cannot be brought into accordance with our emission time, all these processes that occur from the point where the electron is kicked out, maybe one has to rethink what really happens inside. We actually, I personally, I'm not a solid state physicist. I do not know what made the impact, but
it means you could order processes in time, in sequence.
Hopefully, yes.
Can I make a further comment on that? First, this basic process of streaking is a subset of the laser-assisted photoelectric effect, and we actually did those experiments first, and we wrote an extensive paper on what sort of issues you would have if you went to the streaking regime. And you know, it's mostly a manifestation of the fact that, you know, this is not a collinear pump probe experiment because the electron has to come to the surface before it's dressed. So you have this issue that there are four or five different effects that can alter that timing. Most of it is transit time, and you have basically one number, and it just doesn't, I agree that I just don't see that number is all that interesting until you can figure out how to separate and definitively identify these individual effects. So, you know, it's kind of that, is this a bug or a feature, this timing? And I think it's more of a bug than a feature.
Well, I wouldn't say it's more than a bug than a feature. I would say we're really doing a lot of effort to try to separate all these effects that we have, right? I mean, if we try to do a time zero marker, if we do different layers to really get information at different systems to see what might be or what might affect this delay time, and then sort out different physical processes. And I agree, as long as we cannot separate them and quantify what process causes what delay time, it's fuzzy. I absolutely agree, but this is our effort, and that's why I'm also sharing this data, because I hope that people will maybe have ideas how to separate, how to improve experiments.
I'll take the privilege as the chairman to make one remark in defense of the speaker. I think you also showed it for the atom, right? And you have a delay in the atom as well, and that's kind of a relatively well-posed question, which I think deserves an answer and an understanding in xenon. Solid is probably whatever. Yeah,
I agree with that. That it's an issue with the solid, and a lot of it is just what does the field look like, and you know, how are you going to separate it?
Thanks. So I think I have another comment in defense of Reini. I mean, the fact, I think Peter, I think John was basically saying that there is, if you look at individual electrons, there is, so to speak, a quantum uncertainty. You don't know when an electron appears. But this is not the experiment done here. You're not saying that for exactly one electron, the delay is 28 attoseconds. It's an ensemble statement.
Yeah.
There's a systematic delay for the appearance of the electron. I think the atomic case is a really good example. So it really takes a different amount of time for the electron to even appear in the atom, whether it comes from one orbital or the other. And it's not so much one of these uncertainty things. In this sense, I think it's quite significant.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I still on this question, I have two questions, in fact. But first, a comment about this delay. Clearly, the 4D and 5P, I don't remember,
4D5P.
Yeah. Electrons don't see the same atomic potential. So one can be retarded with respect to the other, or another one can be faster than the first because they have not the same kinetic energy when they are exactly emitted, because they have not the same potential. They don't see the same potential, the same centrifugal barrier, and so on. So that's, well, it's a complicated problem, but it is relevant, it's interesting, but I think the answer should be close to this. But
yeah, absolutely, but I mean, if you compare, for example, solid xenon and atomic xenon, you see that that we can separate two different reasons. So yeah. I mean, I absolutely see this point for the atomic system, but then if you look at the solid system, you see that transport effect must also play a role here. And this is the way how we like to separate these individual contributions from each other. Yeah.
So the other question was, did you try in the last things you have shown about the streaking and did you try to simulate that with say the SFA or the strong field approximation or something like this?
Yeah.
And does it fit or not?
Yes, it fits. We are also trying to refine our simulations with spikes shall be there according to the Slack guys. This was the reason why I dared to make a little comment on such a substructure, because our simulations show that if we have individual spikes separated by, they say, 800 attoseconds, then we could even resolve this in the spectra. Mm-hmm. As I showed before, you see when you have a double feature and you streak, then you would end up in a double feature in the energy.
Okay. Thank you.
I have a question about this last measurement as well. Many of us are going to go home tomorrow. Can you send us home with an upper limit on the jitter between LCLS and an external laser?
I would say the conservative upper limit is 100 femtoseconds. I would rather tend to say 50 femtoseconds, because you see, in this picture here, of course, at some points the X-ray pulse is here, right? So it does not hit the laser pulse. And from sorting this, we can conclude on the jitter, because we then would neither see a broadening nor a shift, right? Now we have to find out with statistics. If small broadening that we see could also be could either be due to the fact that we are here, or due to the fact that the bandwidth is jittering itself. So it's extremely hard at this point to really make a good statement. But I would say 50 femtoseconds is not is okay.
The fact that you can actually see streaking, does that mean your pulse is actually shorter than 3 femtoseconds?
Yes, absolutely. This was my statement here on the top left. If we would not have less than 3.5 femtoseconds, so this is the conservative claim here, we would never be able to observe an upshifted feature like this.
Okay, and then see if you change the laser operation parameter, because they can also estimate the pulse duration from a bunch lens, right? Do you see a correlation between what they estimate and what you measure?
Sorry, I didn't
see,
get it.
Now you say this is 3 femtoseconds. Suppose they change the way they run the FEL, right? And
yeah,
make it 10 femtoseconds.
Absolutely. This is what I've been showing here. So here, this is a kind of sorted streaking trace, which is still underlying jitter, because this is only due to the phase cavity timer. But even with the same sorting, you see here with the long pulse that we had, this was something like 70 femtoseconds, you see the sideband structure. This is also photo line, not an O'Shea line.
And the 3 femtosecond operation was done by putting a foil or something?
Yeah, the slotted foil that was shown yesterday by Professor Ueda.
Right, thanks.
So in the 20 picocoulomb mode and with the slotted foiler. Slotted spoiler, sorry. Foiler.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, if I try to think about your solid xenon measurements very naively, then one might think that the 5p electron has higher momentum than the 4d electron, so that as slow the electron moves through the medium, there will be more time for polarization of the medium to develop, so that there will be more dragging due to the interaction with the induced charge. So, and that of course would slow down like the 4d electron, which started first,
yes,
and make it come out later. So the first question is, would that explanation sort of make sense to you?
Absolutely. We also calculated and found something like 6 attoseconds or so. This is what we say, this is the explainable part of the 20 attoseconds that we have.
No, but I'm talking about the difference between solid xenon and the gaseous gas xenon, because then you have a lot thicker medium.
Yes.
And if that explanation makes sense, then of course there is, you don't have to calculate anything. You simply can look up the stopping power measurements for slow electrons, because I'm sure those are available. And mm-hmm. that should tell you exactly how much delay you should have. So if it matches,
point,
then this is your explanation. If it doesn't, then you have to find something else.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah, maybe that's a good final point for the discussion.
Thank
if
you.
It matches, that's fine. Yeah. So thanks again, Reinhard. And come to the second talk, last before noon, by Mark Bracking on connecting harmonic-based and FAL-based XUV X-ray experiments.